Everybody, welcome. So I'm going to talk about this thing that we've been working on for a while. I just made this this picture for it, which I like. I don't know. I'm sure you all like it. Otherwise, if you like it, then say yes. Otherwise, just keep your opinion to yourself. I know it's very great. I guess it'll be clear what it means. Let's see what else I wanted to say. So this is something that this is a work with. Sorry. That's the wrong slide. Okay. This is the first slide. Yeah. So this is a work we've been working on for a while with Ramit Day, who's the main person who's been driving this. He's a postdoc at Western, and I guess partly associated with here at University of Waterloo, but mainly located at Western University. Then Luis Longo, some of you may, Luis Felipe Longo, who some of you might know, who used to visit here just before the pandemic. In fact, he just got out, well, he got out just before the lockdowns started. He's a graduate student in Brazil, and he's defending his PhD today in 1 hour, as I understand. And Subhadip, you guys recognize him, he used to be a postdoc here. Now he's a professor at Tata Institute. And this is now in internal review with LIGO collaboration, so hopefully we should be free to submit it next few days or so. Okay, so let's get started. So what's the main idea? So this is kind of the motivation slide that, so there are two types of stochastic data that we deal with now. Sometimes your models predict things exactly, but sometimes you cannot predict things exactly, like CMB. You cannot exactly predict, there's no model of cosmology that tells you like there are hotspots here, cold spots here, hotspots there. We can predict some statistical properties, but there is no model that we know right now that could predict exactly what the map of the CMB sky should be. Same is true with gravitational waves. We know some properties of say mergers that might happen, but we cannot predict when the mergers are going to happen where. This is, as far as we are concerned, a stochastic. I guess if we knew the exact initial conditions of the universe in either of these two cases, we could predict these maps exactly, but we don't. So as far as we are concerned, our model building in the next probably 1,000 years is concerned, these are stochastic processes. However, there is a difference between these two different stochastic processes. The one on the left, which is the CMB, it's pretty clear that most of the information that we can, at least most of the interesting information that we can get, is in the variance. In fact, the famous CL or multiple or power spectrum plot that you see on the left, it's the variance as the function of angular scale. And as far as we know, most of the interesting cosmological information is there.
Hey, you're gonna drop the coffee.
No, it's the feature. It's an art form. I had to draw. Yeah. Anyway, so, the one on the right, most of what we've seen, like the famous Nobel Prize, I guess actually these both have won Nobel Prizes, but for different things. This is the one thing that won the Nobel Prize on the left is the power spectrum. The one that has won, although I guess Kobe technically won it, right? Yeah. So it wasn't quite as nice when it won the Nobel Prize, but nonetheless, it was the power spectrum that won the Nobel Prize. On the right, what's been seen are these events, like this one, which is from the binary neutron star merger. But these are not kind of a typical thing that you would see in the sky. They are kind of tail of the distribution. Right? If you look at the stochastic, all the gravitational waves that are reaching us from the cosmos, we only see the brightest ones. So the tail of the distribution is what's giving us information right now. Maybe in the far future, we could quantify this, the kind of the variance, but right now what we see is in the tail. So these are two kind of, when we're dealing with the stochastic signals, these are the two kinds of regimes that we can be in. I mean, in principle, it could be somewhere in between, but more often than not, you're either in this regime where most of what you see is the variance, you're kind of around the middle, or most of what you see is in the tail. And of course, you could kind of, the more data you can get, you could either, in fact, for the CMB, it's a struggle to get into the tail. That's like what Kendrick, for example, did with Planck, trying to get the non-Gaussianities, which is still consistent with zero. With gravitational waves, it's the other way around. We're out here, and we're trying to kind of make our way to the variance, and that's what I'm going to talk about. Okay? Of gravitational wave signal.
That's about the strain.
Say the strain, yeah. So I'm saying that what we see are like very loud strains that we can see. So they are kind of out in, you think like, look at a random pixel in the gravitational wave sky, we can only detect the very rare ones, which are very loud. And most of the time, we don't see anything, right? We just see noise. Well, the detector noise, that is. And the CMB, it's the other way around, but most of the time, basically, as far as we know, everything that we see is the variance. We don't see anything beyond the variance. So, yeah.
So by variance, do you mean detecting the sources that dominate the power spectrum of the background?
But I just mean the power spectrum. Yeah, so we don't see the power spectrum. So we just see these very bright sources, other than outliers. The power spectrum we don't see, and that's something that it would be nice to see, and I'm going to talk about how we can go.
So by power spectrum, you mean really a stochastic background,
the gravitational wave? I think it's a little bit tricky what you call a stochastic background and what you say the power spectrum, because, I mean, in some sense, they are the same. In some sense, they're different, right? So there is a stochastic background, which is everything. The very outliers and these, which are the brightest events, we could detect one by one. Things that are sub-threshold, you cannot detect individually, but you might be able to see it stochastically.
Yeah, you should be talking about a background. You're saying in temperature, we have a background, and then we look at the variance of that background. So in gravitational wave, we have a background.
I don't know what you mean by background. So then there's a fluctuations. I don't mean anything about a constant background. They both have fluctuations.
Yeah, I couldn't think of there are probably very hot objects in the space, right? That they have high temperatures.
And there are like clusters in this and things like that. So yeah, I mean, those are the non-interesting. I guess that's why I put interesting here. There is signal in point sources and clusters, but if you ignore those, that's the noise for this, yeah. So. If you are interested in the cosmological part, this is the variance. This is just the tail. This very have interesting information. And basically, the plan of this talk is try to see how can we push kind of from the tail farther down and get towards this variance, but not necessarily all the way. Now, what's obvious here is the reason we have all these great detections with LIGO is there's a very tall tail. No, we shouldn't say there is a very long tail here. That's important, right? There are very bright events. It didn't have to be like that. It didn't have to be. In fact, I mean, 10, 20 years ago, maybe it wasn't obvious that we would see all these events because we didn't know much about binary black holes, their population. But the fact is, it turns out that for gravitational wave, most of the signal is in the tail, at least for now. And over time, we might kind of, as your detectors get better, we're going to build our way towards things that are more typical and try to quantify it. Right now, what's happening here is all noise. We don't actually know what's here. But we can't see. This is like something I made just, yeah. There's nothing fundamental. I'm just saying that one is the Gaussian, the other is something with a skewness in it. Yeah, so don't read too much in there. OK. So what happens if we cannot detect an event? Basically, LIGO has some detection threshold. Is it 5 sigma, 7 sigma? Things that are below that, these are sub-thresholds. That means that there's a chance that there could be due to noise. There are a lot of them, at least right now. And they would contribute to this stochastic gravitational wave background, but we cannot just with the current detectors see them one by one. Of course, with better detectors, we can see more of them. But at least for the next 10, 20 years, there will be, I mean, most of the events will be subthreshold events. So we have to try to, if we want to learn something about them, we should try to do it stochastically. We cannot like detect them one by one. So the way that it's been done traditionally, so basically there are these two different pipelines that are most widely used. One is looking for events one by one, and the other is looking for some stochastic background by correlating the two detectors. So this is basically measuring the detector cross power spectrum between, say, LIGO and Hanford or Virgo. And the idea is that the noise is uncorrelated between these detectors, but the signals should be correlated. The signal would be gravitational wave source, which passes through all detectors. So that should be correlated. There's a catch, though. The catch is that there's a time delay between the detectors. They don't see the same thing. The detectors, I mean, they see the same events, but they come from a direction of the sky that we don't know. And if you don't know where the source is, if you cannot detect it individually, it could be anywhere. And depending on which direction they come from, there is a time delay between like plus or minus 10 milliseconds that kills the correlation between these detectors for frequencies bigger than 30 hertz. And this is a plot from the latest LIGO measurement of this stochastic background from Karas correlation technique, which you see is most sensitive at around 30 hertz. And the reason it basically this upper limit goes up is at higher frequencies, basically there is no cross correlation because of the time delay. So we don't know what the time delay is. And so the limits become basically very, very loose. They go up like a power law here. Actually, they should go up exponentially, I think. Yeah, because you don't see it here. But the limits become basically very, what's the right word I'm looking for? Unrestricted, basically, at higher frequencies. So this is the black is what we have right now. And with the design sensitivity LIGO, you get to the dashed one. And then dot dashed one is, I guess, this design A plus, which I don't know if something that's is still happening or supposed to happen. I don't know. I'm not sure somebody knows. You know?
No, I just want to.
OK, sure.
Mm-hmm. If you're interested in background, why should time delay be important?
Good. So this background is not is a background from astrophysical sources. So something goes off somewhere in the sky. And LIGO sees it at some point. Hanford sees it at some time. Virgo sees it another time. But then because it could go off anywhere in the sky, so you basically see the sum of,
But like you're not interested in the tail anymore. You want to like measure the variance using
it. Yeah, but still it's made out of all these faint events, right? It's just that what's happening is, and in fact, I had a plot of this, I think. So this is like the example of what, so like Hanford and Livingston, yes, there's a signal that passes through them. They're not very loud. This is, of course, very loud. We can see it directly. But generally, there's something that you see. This is Hanford, say. This is Livingston, which is a little bit shifted. All right? I guess the sign is also different, but let's forget about that. Let's imagine my multiply by minus sign. But then an event that comes from this direction in the sky is like this. Another event that comes from the other direction in the sky would be maybe the time shift would be different. So you multiply Hanford and Livingston, but since you don't know the direction, you could be multiplying this by this, or you could be multiplying this by this, and that changes the sign, basically. Well, at low frequencies, this doesn't, but at high frequencies, it does change the sign. So you get basically cancellation. And basically, the cancellation is just like cosine of omega delta t. Right. So that's what you get.
Sorry.
Yeah.
This time delay is what actually people use to localize the events, right?
If you can see an event, that's true. If you can detect an event, yeah, indeed, you try to fit the waveform. But of course, if you don't know where the event is, if it's a very faint event, it could be anywhere. So the cross correlation. So basically, what you do, you want to add this cross correlation over all faint events, but that means that you're averaging this cosine of omega delta t.
So you want to cross correlate the part of the spectrum that there is no event.
Right, so there is no detectable event. So there are faint, lots of faint events. So I'm gonna show you a picture. So I don't know if there are any other points about it. So basically, the point is that at low frequencies, all the detectors see the same thing. But at high frequencies, detectors see different things because of the time delay. And since we don't know which direction they're coming for, it's done. Basically, if you average over a lot of the events, it suppresses the signal. And this is the reason that this thing goes up. Your sensitivity, your error goes up, means your sensitivity goes down at high frequencies.
So how is this different than just looking for, you know, the candidates that are sub-threshold?
Well, I mean, that's the point. You want to look for them, but the question is, what's the best way of looking for them? So you cannot detect them individually because. Oh, you could, okay, have a large candidate.
Sigma,
yeah.
Have lots and lots of false positives. But if you know the noise,
yeah. Yeah.
You can then compute the statistics of those false positives.
Yeah, I'm guessing at some level it becomes prohibitive. But yeah, I think you could, that's probably, you're going to have a large sample of positivity. I'm actually not sure if that's the optimal way of doing it. Because they're all going to start blending together at some point. But
if you're looking, like you were saying that at low signals of noise, the optical gap becomes like near one.
At some point, it becomes. They're going to start overlapping at some point. But I think you're right that there is a regime. If you have enough computational resources, they could just run a sky, all many. Go look for one up to down to one sigma events. I don't know.
Yeah. Right. You know, so they search all possible templates at all possible starting times.
Yeah.
And they get a catalog of candidates.
Yeah.
Keep the ones that are like 10 sigma, right?
Yeah.
But you're saying that in principle, there's more information present even below 10 sigma.
There is more information.
Sigma.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So I'm asking, why not just look at
five sigma thing?
Five sigma, four sigma.
Yeah. No, I think that makes sense. The question is, at what point does it become prohibitive, too? Because there are many more 5 sigma than there are 10 sigma.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So that means, you know, characterizing really well the noise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be. I think that would be one way to go. So I guess what I want to propose is something that's a bit, more economical, basically, than keeping track of all individual events.
But they've already done that. Already searched for all possible templates.
Okay.
Right.
Right.
So therefore, So therefore, it's coming for free, right?
Well, down to some threshold, 5 sigma, you say, for example. I don't know what is the threshold that they've come down to.
It's just the candidates that they make capable. I'm saying though that, you know, in principle, their template search has all possible.
I'm confused. What do you mean? Like, do they have templates for all possible distribution of faint exposures in different directions? Because that would all contribute different time delays.
The thing is, the number of these increases exponentially with the number of sigma.
The number of false positives.
The number of false positives, exactly. So you get exponentially more and more false positive. So you get less and less information in principle. Yeah. Yeah. So that's the only thing. It seems that it's hard, but I mean, in principle, there is all the information is there. You just have to work much harder to extract it, right? So, I mean, I agree that.
Monash.
Yes.
Monash group is doing something like that, right? So we had the speaker, probably 1 year ago, something talking about exactly that. So they use some Bayesian approach for the threshold events, and then combine all the sub-threshold events to get an estimate on the astrophysical stochastic background. I guess the difficulty there is to somehow computationally it's very demanding, and also the noise of the detector is not completely Gaussian. You have to somehow correctly characterize those glitches, and it turns out these kind of things also damage this kind of estimate if you don't properly a model the glitches. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think that could be a.
People are doing that.
That's a very, as Juan was saying, that's another issue that, I mean, you have to understand your nodes also much better if you wanna, if you're looking like one event out of 500 nodes or something like that. So you have to understand the tail of your noise very well. But yeah, so that's certainly one way to go. That's like a brute first at some level. So we are looking for an alternative which we could run on a work on a laptop. Okay, so, and just this aside, which is, I mentioned cross power spectrum here. You may wonder why we don't look at the auto power spectrum. And the reason for that is that, in fact, auto power spectrum for LIGO is not well understood. These are all various sources of auto power spectrum. I don't know how well you guys can see this. Yeah. And I know it's very messy, but the thing to pay attention to is that there is a difference between the black line and the blue line. The blue line is the actual measured noise, and the black line is the predicted noise. And it looks basically there's a difference, which is very significant. And if you actually do that, this is something I did at some point, is informally known as a mystery noise. And I had a proposal for how to explain that, but that's a separate issue. So the point is that, I mean, the auto power spectrum, we don't understand it, so we cannot actually use it. But okay, let's move on from this. However, there is something interesting that we want to use, and the fact that the spectrograms remain correlated over a much longer time scale. So if you look at this LIGO, so this is the binary neutron star merger event. You could see that these two patterns remain coherent over many seconds and obviously correlated because you see the same pattern. The time delay between the two is 10 milliseconds, so the waveforms become uncorrelated over many seconds, but the power remains coherent. So if we could actually look at the correlation between these two spectrograms, which is basically frequency versus time, or power spectrum as a function of time with some window, then that could basically differentiate between astrophysical signal and noise, because the noise should be uncorrelated between these two. But if you see a chirping pattern that happens in both of them, if they're correlated, basically it's coherent, then that should be astrophysical. Okay? Any questions? So another way to think about it is to think about the non-Gaussian nature of the astrophysical signal. Basically, if this thing is non-Gaussian because the structure in different frequencies are correlated with each other. For Gaussian noise, different frequencies are uncorrelated. But here, clearly what you see is that if you see a signal at this frequency, you see a signal at the next frequency and the next frequency, but at the slightly later times. So clearly, the structure is very non-Gaussian here because you see this coherence in frequency. And it's a very predictable coherence in frequency. So if we could actually use that, which is a type of non-Gaussianity, is essentially a type of four-point function, at least. Or it could go to higher point function as well. But it starts at four-point function. Then you could peek into this non-Gaussian tail. One way to think about it is that these mergers happen like once every second, and this is something that Shovadip did with Joe Silk. This is the rate of mergers as a function of frequency of the mergers, that mean the emission frequency. And you see this is like less than a hertz or less than 1 per second. So you could actually see these kind of happening one after another. They don't blend together, at least at for these properties. That is they assumed here. So this is kind of listening for like popcorn popping in the microwave. Like they go off once every second or so, and depending on like is it early or late. Because if it slows down, that means you have to turn off your microwave. Otherwise, it's going to burn your popcorn. When you are in this regime that you can kind of hear the pops individually, that's basically when that means that you have these chirps kind of not overlapping. So if you have one chirp and then another chirp and another chirp, those are each like one of the pops in the microwave. And as long as this is a very non-Gaussian signal, so if you could look for them, actually, let's put it another way. So another way to think about it is that the power spectrum is time dependent. So the stochastic gravitational wave background is not the same all the time. When it's going off, you have something very loud. And when it's quiet, you don't hear anything. So it's a very time dependent or variable stochastic gravitational wave background. Yes?
You're cross correlating all the time domain or just the parts that is paying ops coming?
But that's the thing. We don't actually know where the pops are coming. If they are very loud, if you can actually hear the pops. So I guess I'm imagining if you had a perfect detector, you could actually hear all the pops. But in reality, you have a lot of noise. Imagine like I have a static TV that cannot hear the pops individually. So you try to hear them stochastically. So then you include everything. You have to include everything. But the point is that the pops are distinct from each other with astrophysical signals that we know. So this point that Neil was making, they are actually not overlapping, at least in the regimes that Sovadip and Josil considered. So if as long as they're not overlapping, there is an non-Gaussianity which should be detectable. Right? Or in other words, the power actually is time dependent. Sometimes there are no pops, so it's very quiet. And then when there are pops, it's very loud. And if you look at the power as a function of time, you should be able to you should be able to quantify how the power changes with time, which is essentially it's like a variance of the power, which is a four-point function. So the opposite regime, and if you have pops happening all the time that overlap with each other, then you're in the Gaussian regime. You have the basically central limit theorem that makes it Gaussian. But it turns out, fortunately, for astrophysical signals, we are not there. We are not in the central limit theorem regime, so there should be a significant non-Gaussian tail. And in fact, we are already seeing the non-Gaussian tail. But there is much more of it that we don't directly see, but we can statistically look for. That's kind of the plan. OK? Any questions? No, I'm laboring this a bit too much. But here comes the signal beyond the power spectrum. So this is the temporal dependence of this, the signal. This is not captured by the power spectrum. And we call it a spectrogram correlated stacking, or specs. So this is the great graphic that you all, I know, like. So the idea is that basically we look at the correlation of spectrograms and stack them. Now, here this is something loud that you could detect individually, but imagine that there's much higher noise than these. So you cannot detect them one by one, but you can correlate them and stack them over all the times, and then look see a signal. Now, this is not the best plot here, so I'm going to explain it. Sorry, the screen is small, and this is goes in the wrong direction. But somehow Suvadip liked it this way. Not sure why. So if you can see, the idea is that this is how it works. So you have two detectors that have signals. It's mostly noise, but then orange is the signal, and then blue is the noise. Then what you do is that for both of these, you compute their spectrograms, which is basically a spectrum as a function of frequency with some time resolution. So again, this has one spectrum. This is another spectrogram. Then you cross-correlate the spectrograms as a function of difference in time and difference in frequency. Yeah. I mean, there is, in principle, an optimal way of combining things. We don't know what it is. So like for Virgo, we get much less signal. But it's not a Gaussian statistics, so it's not exactly straightforward. And this is something we've been struggling with to decide what is the best way of combining detectors or, in fact, different frequencies. In principle, what you could do is just weight this by inverse of the noise or the variance of the noise. This is called Wiener filtering. And that's good for Gaussian noise. But then when you look at things that are non-Gaussian, then it becomes weird. And basically, where things become non-Gaussian for us is that you could imagine that the detectors are Gaussian. noise. But then you compute a spectrogram, and a spectrogram is a square of a Gaussian. So its noise is non-Gaussian now. And then, so a spectrogram is, you basically imagine, so these are these things that the famous things you see from LIGO. So it's you imagine some finite time windows, like say for 1 second, or I guess actually shorter, I think like 0.1 second, for example. And you kind of roll it in time, and then within that you compute the power spectrum.
That beating would be very
Yeah, so your resolution, it's up to you. Now, but experiment tells you what the noise is here, right? So if it's, I mean, the noise of, the property of this noise, and in fact, yeah, I can show you, let me see, actually, where was the Virgo? Didn't I have a picture of Virgo? Maybe I didn't put the picture of Virgo here. Okay, like, but like for Virgo, you don't see anything here. These things?
Yeah, you do a Fourier transform or something, but your Fourier transform is in a finite spinning or.
Yeah, that's right. So, but what you do to get the spectrogram is you have this function. This is a function of time, and then you kind of multiply it by a Gaussian, multiply it by some Gaussian, and then compute this Fourier transform. And then you move your Gaussian here and then compute Fourier transform again. And you kind of keep doing this, and that gives you basically, so at every time you have a power spectrum, and that's known as a spectrogram.
So you're high pass filtering your data.
Yes.
And
you're moving the center of your window. Right. Yep, center of the high pass filter indeed. Yep.
Or no, I'm sorry.
It's high pass because, well, yeah, I mean you kill all the low frequencies, right? So there is a minimum frequency resolution. If this is delta t, there is a minimum frequency. So delta f is. You multiply by a Gaussian window. Yep, you're multiplying by a Gaussian window. Yeah, so I guess it's not a high pass filter because it's not in frequency space. So it's a real space filtering, but it does kill the low frequencies. So yeah, so it's not what technically is called a high pass, because high pass filter, you go in frequency space and multiply by a factor. Here, when you compute a spectrogram, you just take the data, multiply it by the Gaussian, and then with whatever is left to its Fourier transform, or power spectrum, basically. And then you could kind of keep moving this to different times. And then you get a basically power spectrum at different times, and that's what this picture is. I can give you maybe a slightly better picture. You're like, this is another one. So this is from some realistic injections that we did. So this is how the signal looks like. Where is to have this chirping behavior for binary black holes. And then this is how the noise looked like on the right-hand side. And in reality, I guess you add the signal to noise. Yeah. OK.
That delta t is proportional to rate of those pops that
This delta t? Oh, no. So this delta t is just the resolution you have in time here, which I think it's around 0.1 second or so here. So you just look at, what you do is that you look at your data in time. So this is like data in time. And you just look at windows or this Gaussian, multiply it by Gaussian windows. So you just focus data at different points and then compute this Fourier transform. So wherever you have one of these pops happening, which are these binary black hole mergers, then each of these pops is something that looks like this, like one of these. I mean, we kind of truncate the in spiral, but there's in spiral merger and ring down, so which is a tiny fraction of the noise. The noise is much bigger than this. So this part is your pops. Don't know what happened here. This is your pops, and if you look at the spectrogram, which is you look at basically a spectrum as a function of time, this is how it looks like. So you don't have anything, and as soon as you approach a measure, you have this basically this thing that becomes loud, and then you have nothing again. Okay. Yes.
Sorry, I think I'm having difficulty on the next slide. How you kind of
this one?
Yeah. Okay. Figure out how that pop is there. Is that like if you zoom in really closely?
Oh, here you.
That's what it would look at like.
Even yeah, yeah. Because noise is very big. So, I mean, in reality, of course, we don't see these individually. This is an injection, so we know exactly where we put the signal and what is the noise. But in reality, what you see is the noise. You cannot, I mean, if you just look here, it just looks like noise to you. So that's why we have to be clever and look cross-correlate signals between detectors to actually see there is a signal there.
Right. Is this still cross-correlating between detectors rather than like an autocorrelation?
So, I mean, the problem is this noise is huge. And if you just correlate it with itself, you just see noise.
Okay.
There's not much else. But then if you have two different detectors, these are independent noises, but these signals are the same. So in other words, if you look at, but except for the tiny time delay, so this thing is the same between all the detectors,
okay.
But this is completely different.
Kind of, so this is still, you don't really know what the time delay is. You just know these signals happen, you know.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is that time delay doesn't matter for this. Because you see, this is like seconds, and time delay is like 10 milliseconds at most.
Okay.
So the time delay doesn't do anything to this. For the strains, for this signal, the time delay, if I look at the correlation of this between the two detectors, the time delay kills this, basically, except for very low frequencies. But if I square this, basically, which is what the spectrogram is doing, I kill the oscillations, these tiny oscillations. And then the time delay doesn't do anything. You see what I'm saying?
So is the squaring like a new thing?
It's squaring a new thing, basically, right?
So this is different from. Wait,
so before people just correlated this between the two detectors, which is mostly noise, but now what we're doing is we're just squaring it and correlate them. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And squaring kills these fast oscillations in time. And but by saying squaring is this spectrogram, which is basically squaring it, but in a frequency dependent way. Good. So, and this is the result for injection, how it looks like for some population of binary black holes injected in some redshift range between 0.1 to 1 in range of 10 solar mass to 90 solar masses and with a bunch of other kind of realistic expectations. And what you see is this is the signal that you get after you, there's always a background from noise because of course if you correlate this thing with itself. Not with itself. There's noise for Hanford and noise for Livingstone. They would be independent, but if you correlate them, you're going to get something. And that something is almost zero, but not exactly. And you have to subtract it because noise is so big. So if you subtract that, so basically there's a huge background on this, which is almost constant. But if you subtract that background, then this is what you get, which is the signal. So what you see is that there is a high degree of correlation, or there could be a high degree of correlation if you have a strong enough signal, around delta t of 0, because, as I said, the time delay is less than 10 milliseconds, so the two signals should be correlated within like less than 10 milliseconds here, which is what you see, and within delta f of around 0, although this could be broad in delta f. It doesn't have to be very narrow in delta f. Which is to say that if you look at these signals, they are coherent in frequency. So the width in frequency could be tens of hertz. So I don't have or if you look here, these span in frequency in tens of hertz, or even up to 100 hertz. So this is not very sharp in frequency, but it's very sharp in delta t. And the fact that there is anything with delta f not equal to 0, that means that it's not Gaussian. I mean, because in Gaussian signal, there is only correlation at the same frequency. So So beyond for delta f in order to equal to zero, there is no signal. The fact that we see this, that means that it's an non-Gaussian signal, which is not surprising because we injected these binary black hole mergers, which are not Gaussian.
If you're saying that your estimator has some large noise bias, and so you have to subtract that noise bias by computing what it is, and so that's how you compute what the noise bias is.
So the noise bias, the nice thing about it is it doesn't depend on delta t. So we don't actually compute it. We just look at everywhere other than delta t equal to zero, because the noise of the detector, Hanford and Livingston, are independent. So you have this huge thing, but it doesn't depend on delta t. So basically, all you have to do is that look at this for delta t not equal to zero, and that's your noise bias. Right. So basically, the way to think about it is that there is this huge mountain. But this huge mountain only depends on delta f, and there's a tiny blip on it, right? Okay, which depends on both delta t and delta f.
Right? So how large are these blips compared to your mountain? Sorry,
it's very big. Like I don't know, six or no, not I don't have it off the top of my head, but it's really this comparison, right? It's yeah. So you see, this is 10 to the minus 18. This is 10 minus 23. Yeah, so it's huge. It's almost ridiculous. So I don't have it off the top of my head. So I mean, we do some whitening kind of stuff that makes it a little bit more manageable. But I don't have it. I think it's like three or four orders of magnitude at the end, whatever is left.
So, yes. But this mountain is not flat, right? So it also oscillates.
The mountain?
Right? Yeah.
Well, so if the, there are random fluctuations, but if you assume that the noise in LIGO, noise in Hanford and Livingston, which is detectors that are, like one is in Washington State and the other is in Louisiana, if they assume those are independent noises, on average, there would be, this should be flat. Now, there is fluctuations in it, so you have to characterize like a stochastic fluctuations, like the sample variance in the noise. But I mean, yes, it does fluctuate, and those fluctuations are, that's the noise that's left, basically. So if you look here, there are these fluctuations, right, that's left, basically, after you subtract the background.
But your signal you're saying is...
So they happen to be much smaller than the noise itself, you're saying, right?
Well, that depends on how strong your signal is. But yeah, so you have to, that's the noise that's left, and you have to characterize the leftover noise. And if your signal is stronger than that, then you have detection. If it's not stronger than that, then you don't have detection, basically. So that's, but indeed, there is a leftover noise, and that we have to quantify. Alex? Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm just going to ask, I mean, in the real data, is this assumption that noise is independent, is it actually good? I mean, like,
between the two detectors?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's like a large earthquake or there are other.
I've heard that there are some sort of a thunderstorm, like ionospheric stuff that could correlate things. I don't know how big it is, but people have speculated about that. So there is, I mean, earthquake, I don't think so, because the speed of sound is much slower than the speed of light. So, but there is this ionospheric thunderstorms that Shubhadeep has talked about. I forgot it has a name. So there is that. Maybe that will be something. But I don't think people know exactly how much it is. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, because you see, something should propagate with the speed of light from one side of US to the other side, which I don't know. I suppose, I mean, like the Super Bowl or something. Maybe something like that could be. I haven't thought about that, but I suppose, yeah, if there's like some sort of an event that happens everywhere at the same time, that could be. But I haven't thought about it, like the Super Bowl or what else, like New Year's Eve. Okay. Yeah, everyone like everybody celebrates, jumps up and down at the same
time.
But something should happen at the same time everywhere, right? Like within 10 milliseconds or so, right? That's the only way that this could happen. So within 10 milliseconds, if everyone jumps up and down, I guess in the US, I can see that happening. Okay. Super Bowl could do it. But then, so that's why Virgo is important, because the football means something very different there. sorry, I Neil, you want to say something?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. So, so if I wanted to estimate like the sample variance in your flat thing,
yeah.
Would it be roughly like this mean divided by square root of number of samples?
Yep, that's the idea, yeah.
And so therefore, to express this, like, you know, this like, sample variance by five orders of magnitude.
I need a lot of them, yeah.
So it'd be 10 out of 10 samples?
I mean, of course, we don't have 10 to the 10 samples. So if it was really 10 to the 5, I think that's true. Although now I'm just thinking. I think there is something about that that doesn't quite sound right, because we don't have 10 to the 5 10 to the 10 samples. Somehow this is what's left. And I'm not sure, because I mean, these are the noises that are left after you subtract the background. So for whatever reason, this is how much we have. So I don't. But what you say is right. So basically, things are uncorrelated from 10 milliseconds, every 10 millisecond segment. And let's see, we have how many days do you have data? I think we had like for this view the month of data. So like how many 10 milliseconds there is in a month? I don't know.
Like a tenth of a year?
Yeah, so it's like 10 to the 5, 10 to the 7 or so we have, I think. I don't know. That's off the top of my head, the number. So maybe it's not 10 to the 10, but maybe that's not 10 to the 5 either. So this is what's left, at least. Yeah.
Is it possible to, there is a kind of foreground contamination from source errors that produce some kind of correlated?
Well, if it's from source, then it's not noise, and if it's signal. Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know. Whatever that's, both detectors can see and it's not in Earth, then I guess it's a signal of something.
The number of milliseconds in a month is about 10 to 10, 10 to 10 to 10.
Is it? Well, I think a year is like pi times 10 to the 7 seconds, and then that would be 10 to the pi times 10 to the 10 milliseconds. So it's in the right ballpark. The exact numbers, I guess one has to figure it out. But that's where this noise comes from anyway. So, So this is an example of like how this looks like at different delta Fs. So like delta F of 0, this is for one of our like optimistic injections. This is the signal. And you shouldn't really pay too much attention to what the value is, because we have some model. Nobody has seen these stochastic gravitational wave backgrounds, so we have models for it. But we don't necessarily believe them at all. So this is just one model. This just demonstrates how delta F makes a difference. So at delta F equal to 0, you have the strongest correlation, which is what you see here. But as you go to delta F other than 0, then you get kind of less correlation. And then the blue is the noise realizations, which is basically looking at this signal, but at delta t's that are not 0. Right. OK? And the nice thing about this method is that we actually looked it for synthetic Gaussian noise, which are not very realistic. But you could basically do the same thing with realistic noise of LIGO. And then it would be glitches that would be kind of somewhere in the tail. And you can get a better, more realistic estimates of p-value from that. So we haven't done that. That's we're leaving that for future work. The noise is also non-Gaussian, because we are squaring a Gaussian. So the noise becomes non-Gaussian, as it turns out. Then there are this filtering couples everything together. So there is. This is like the covariances. So remember, I told you about the spectrogram. This is your signal, but it has a noise, and its noise is also correlated in delta T and delta F. The correlation in delta T was very small, I told you, but there is correlation in delta F, which looks like this. You don't have to think too much about it, but the point is that you have to include this covariance between delta Fs. These are not independent measurements at different delta Fs. They are all correlated. And you have to include that correlation. And this is basically what you get for a signal as a function of delta t. So basically, if you try to, if you just take this thing, which was a function of delta t and delta f, and combine them into one number at every delta t, including the covariance, then that should be your signal. And it peaks at delta t of 0. This is like different, two different injection regimes. One is a high merger rate that you have a high signal to noise around 8. This is a lower merger rate where you have a signal to noise of 4 at delta t of 0. And the way to quantify it is really just by this is noise, this is signal. You say, OK, how often something like this can be seen in this noise? That's the way to quantify the p-value for this.
So, Binary, you don't get information besides this doesn't look like noise. Is that how I should interpret this, or is there?
Oh no, you could fit the whole, depends on the signal to noise. You could fit this thing with the model, right? So the first step is to have a detection, but then of course, if you have a significant enough detection, then the shape of this tells you about the population of binaries and all their properties, right? Because basically, the spread in delta T and delta F, I think the spread in delta T mostly tells you about the time delay, so because things are spread. But then the spread in delta F tells you about the masses. I mean, the bigger masses have smaller frequencies, right? No, this is a stacking, like, I think it's like 100,000 events or something like that, yeah. Yeah. And in fact, actually, I had the number here. This is 10,000 events. So this is like how the signal to noise builds up with the number of injected events. And you have two different regimes. This is the large rate, where basically you have a lot of events, like one per second. And then this is a small rate. I think it's one every 10 seconds or something like that. And you see that, if you have high injection rates for the same number of events, you can get like large signal to noise. This is but for low injection rates, basically there's a lot more noise, so you get the smaller signal to noise after the same number of events. Yes?
You distribute your events evenly in the time.
It's random. Basically, it's a Poisson. So this is an example. Like this is, well, I guess this doesn't actually tell you how even it is. But it's with some rates, but it's Poisson sampling. Okay, so I think, I'm almost out. So this is like a combined three detectors. This is LIGO, Hanford, and Virgo. And the signal to noise increases a little bit. This is for the high merger rate. So it kind of goes from, it doesn't actually make too much of a difference. It goes from like 8 to 9, right? This is 8. And then if you include Virgo with the optimal weighting, you go to 8.5. In fact, it doesn't make too much of a difference for Virgo for now. And this is something, basically this is a money plot in some sense, which is this compares the signal to noise you get from the standard method I described early on by cross-correlating detectors. And then this is this method. As a function of maximum frequency that's included, and this shows you two things, which is kind of puzzling. So for cross-correlation, it just most of its signal is around, as I said, beyond 30 hertz. It mostly dies out. I mean, for this injection, we get a little bit more signal. But the reason for that is, the plot I showed you before was for omega gravitational waves. This is for signal to noise. So they're slightly different things. But most of it comes basically dies after 50 hertz or so, or after 60 hertz. So this is for a standard method. For this specs, you get signal up to as high a frequency as you want to go. There is a weird thing that happens at, if you include very high frequencies, SNR goes down. And that's weird. And we try to understand it, but the best we could understand is just this is not an optimal estimator. So if you have, if you're adding a lot of frequencies that don't have signal but only have noise, and we don't have in these injections, we don't have a lot of signal here, we just have mostly noise, then it actually dampens or dilutes your signal. So it makes a little bit of difference, but yeah, it does actually go down, and we tried different things, and it does go down, which just kind of suggests there is probably some optimal frequency range that you want to use for these specs.
So, Niash?
Yes.
So I guess what you are trying to claim is why this is better than the correlation technique is because you gain more information from the high frequency signals. Well, you have, right, so the time delay effect is more severe for those high frequency signals.
Yes.
So that so have you tried, for example, assuming you have detectors located at the same place, so like two detectors at the same place, I mean, you can do that. So for that, those cases, the time delay is zero. So you don't need to consider that. And run your analysis again against the cross correlation technique, right? So in that case, the cross correlation has to be better than your method. It's cross correlating signal, not power. So it's by definition.
I think that's a good point. I think we looked at that at some point, and it's not better. And the reason is there is a still non-Gaussian, even if you look at the same point. This is still a non-Gaussian signal. And if you just look at the variance, there is no reason that it has all the information. I mean, you have still information. Because it's a non-Gaussian stochastic background.
First, you need the other detector far away to subtract the noise, because the one at the same location, also the noise gets...
Well, right. So I think Juan is thinking as a matter of principle. If the time delay is a problem, if the detectors were in the same place, and you still imagine that the noise was uncorrelated, then the time delay wouldn't be a problem. Yeah, I think we did that at some point. I don't have it here, but I think you get like something like 4 instead of 2, or about 1.5 here, if you assume that there is no time delay between the detectors. But you still get more signal here, and I think the reason is that it's not a Gaussian signal, so there is no reason that you should get everything from power spectrum, basically. We can put that plot here as well. But as I said, I disagree with you that this should be better, because still you're looking at the variance, and if it's a non-Gaussian signal, there is more information in higher order statistics. If you do use a template and then you...
But can't you just take the observed signal from one as the template?
You see, what's the point? So the problem is you don't detect these, right? These are just could be anywhere. So most of what you see is noise, right? Or very faint events that are effectively noise or just noise, okay? If you're just multiplying the signal by itself, you're mostly multiplying noise by itself. Sometimes you're multiplying signal by itself. But if you square the signal and then multiply it, because signals are stronger, then you give more weight to like outliers. So that's the point. That's the point, is that the simple cross correlation, because you're summing over everything, not just the events. It's mostly just summing noise. But if you do this as specs, you give more weight to the tails. So you give less weight to the noise and more weight to where something is an outlier. So I think even if it wasn't for the time delay, this would work better because you're looking for outliers. Because outliers are more important. That's why LIGO keeps seeing the outliers, right? The question is the noise the same or different? Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a different detector. So in principle, yeah. 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 So. No, these are like some random realization of properties, like random masses and spins and things like that. Yeah. So let me wrap up. I think I'm past the time. So the point here is that this is what I showed you from LIGO, from where the limit is and then where the limit is going to be. And basically, the hope is we're going to push this down by an order of magnitude. So I guess with current sensitivity, with O3, this may barely get to what's observable, so we're not going to have a detection. But I think with design sensitivity, And with these projections for these models, I guess there's a good chance that we may get a detection. We haven't done this analysis properly. We just did it with these kind of toy injections that I told you. But this is the next step to actually look at more realistic injections and see, will we have a detection? So, but with the current sensitivity of the LIGO, or even design sensitivity of the LIGO, and the current models for binary neutron star and binary black hole, we don't expect to have a detection. We're going to get just we may just reach the observable. It's not going to be 5 sigma. But hopefully, with this new method, we're going to have a detection, because we're going to push this by a factor of 10. OK, so that's all. Thank you. Other questions?
OK. If there are two components in the background, one is a primordial component, one is astrophysical, as you discussed.
Yeah.
Is it possible to distinguish the two by your method?
I guess so. I think that would be a cool application, because this here we're trying to look for something as non-Gaussian, and primordial signal like CMB is probably very Gaussian. Of course, that depends on the kind of primordial signal. But yeah, so that's not going to show up in the specs. So the only, because again, here this is designed for something that's very non-Gaussian, and the primordial signal, if it's Gaussian, it's not going to be correlated across different frequencies. Right.
How do you distinguish the two? From where can you see there are two components?
So this thing, remember I said this delta F is around like here, 64 hertz? So that's this coherence time that you see here, right? So if there's a primordial Gaussian signal, there would be a spike here. That would be delta function, basically, delta f of 0. Yeah. So that would be, yeah. So basically, if you want to do this, you have to fit for a profile which is a smoothing frequency and one is a spiky in frequency.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. Good, but that's a good point. Any other questions? Well, now then, let's have lunch. Thanks, everyone.